All right. Welcome to the Renegade HPG podcast. My name is Travis and my guest today is Anthony Scroggins, BattleTech art director and all-around mech fan. You may know Anthony better by his name, Shimmering Sword, which is where you can find him on Patreon, Deviant Art, Twitter, and the like. Anthony has had his nose to the grindstone recently, producing all of the new sculpts for the massively successful Clan Invasion Kickstarter, but finally has a chance to come up for air and has been kind enough to sit down with me today to talk all things BattleTech. Anthony, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Yeah, so I just checked on the CrowdOx page, and it looks like you're up to just shy of $6 million on this Kickstarter, and you are a big guy in delivering what people are wanting from that Kickstarter. So, one, thank you, for all the sculpts that you've been doing, and kind of what has it been like, with that work and kind of the design, and are you officially off the clock now with a break, or are you kind of diving into kind of future projects? What's that look like for you?
Right. Yeah. The Kickstarter is insanity, but it's been good to get through it. And, it's still fun along the way, even if it's really hard work. Like you said, the CrowdOx funding is crazy. Like the initial funding was amazing. Yeah, that was awesome. And then just it kept going up. Clearly, nobody has budget control in this situation, because my saying is that everybody's been spending twice as much as they thought they would have. But no, it's cool to see the funding come in, see Catalyst get funded in a way it hasn't had before, just with stuff like you've seen the Legends book come out. It's the things we can do now that we couldn't do before is really interesting, because art is not cheap. As far as work things, I do have all the Kickstarter side stuff done. There's still some line art to do, but that kind of goes around everywhere. Like the rec guides have been coming out, so we're getting them done as the rec guides need them. But no, work is never over. It is a little more chill now, but it's never over.
Well, you're not trying to beat the Chinese New Year now, so at least you got a little bit of a buffer there, in terms of the timetable. Definitely. And now you've been involved officially with Catalyst since, I think it was 2018 as the art director, but you've certainly been working them for a lot before then, I believe just on contract work. What has been the change just in terms of the, kind of the character of BattleTech and the company side, from kind of pre-Kickstarter to post-Kickstarter? Because, BattleTech was essentially kind of, holding on by its fingernails, for many, many years. And this has really kind of brought it back into the limelight. And there's definitely a lot of new blood coming into it as a result.
Yeah, kind of like I hinted at earlier, before of course, still want every product you make to be a profitable product. But before, it was this very razor thin, can we afford to make it? And then will it sell enough to make back what it cost? And some products that seem like they're a good idea are just too expensive to make in the moment. So yeah, you're seeing stuff like Legends, where it's kind of just a beautiful book that didn't necessarily have to be made, but they knew people would like to see. Now it's more, what great products can be made. Whereas before it's like, well, we really like this thing, but we have to cut it because it's not making money or it's costing too much to get across the finish line. I think a lot of people are asking, like the field manuals, kind of the field manuals, but more recently the combat manuals, where we got Mercs and Kurita done.
Yeah.
And then the next one we were working on was Davian. That seemed like a no-brainer, sell to all the Davian players. And they're like, no, it's not pushing enough. They had to stop. It's pretty sad there, especially when it was a somewhat Alpha Strike oriented product, and Alpha Strike desperately needed product and we just couldn't do it. So yeah, there's definitely, it's more looking forward to like how cool we can make BattleTech instead of before. It's, what can we afford to do for it? Yeah.
And I don't know if this knowledge is kind of above your pay grade or not, but fans are always asking for things, and of course people are always going to ask for things without any concept of kind of the business side. But do you have an idea of kind of what the purchase thresholds are, what the profit margins need to be to kind of justify, you know, the development of a product there. Like how many people need to buy the Davian, you know, combat manual mm-hmm. in order for it to be a product that's worth investing in production.
Yeah, I can confidently say not only do I not get told that stuff, I have no idea. Once you run some basic math on certain products, books are harder because there's such a wide band of what a book is going to cost you, especially now they're doing print on demand.
Yeah.
So certainly that costs more per book, but then it also means no upfront print run costs.
Right, right.
But at least with miniatures, you can do some very generous production costs for those and figure out quickly that once you've paid the artists and paid the manufacturers to make it, you actually have to sell a lot of those miniatures mm-hmm. to break even on them. So
yeah.
I'm always trying to be fair to Catalyst on, you know, this is a business. We're trying to go big and it's very expensive. So even during the success, you got to keep in mind, like, we're moving a lot of money. I think Randall in the AMA somewhere he's mentioned moving a lot of money.
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I mean, in my nonprofit days when I was managing that, I mean, we would bring in, you know, for a nonprofit, it was $750,000 a year. And I mean, we still got to the end of the year and we were behind, you know, and so it's yep. amazing sometimes how much money goes in and out and you're still not, you know, turn it, you're not in the black, you know, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. you multiply that by a, you know, an actual kind of commercial product versus kind of a nonprofit service. And yeah, I have an imagination, you know, my experience has given me a little bit of insight into that. But you know, certainly you have a unique role now because you're not just an artist, but you're also the director in terms of kind of building and managing a team. And so maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, what is that like and what, you know, what does your role, you know, kind of, how does it fill within the Catalyst kind of grand scheme and kind of who does what, you know, what does it look like the production of, you know, taking, you know, okay, the Kickstarter says we have to redo the Centurion now, you know, so, you know, what are the steps to kind of making that from, okay, we know we got to do it to here's the sculpt to share with everybody.
Yeah, of course, that's all the fun part of my job. But yeah, it's, geez, I got to process this on my mind for a second. But yeah, so I get a bit of say in the, like, which mechs we pick, or I'll at least see the list that our bosses are looking at, you know, Randall, Brent, Ray, and I'll provide my feedback in there as well. But it is a lot of, you know, it comes down from the top and, you know, we want to see a lot of mechs done. So usually it's pretty agreeable. The first Kickstarter, there's so many mechs that we did revise once me and my sculpt team was brought in and they asked, well, hey, what do you guys think of the list? We revised quite a bit. And I think that played into that early switcheroo chaos, even once they went live, because we were like, hey, what about this mech and this mech? And I even got out of Brent at one point, like, whoa, that mech's not on our list. We have to have that on our list. So I'm like, yeah, you guys missed some.
Yeah.
But and there's, yeah, you gave me a lot to cover, but I'll put
let's say, like, what is the, you know, who does what on your team? It's kind of like, what are right. the various roles within that system?
Yeah, I guess to clarify my role more, we still have Brent Evans is the head art director of the company, so he's still within BattleTech is like the art director above me. I would say I'm the sculpt director.
Okay.
Basically, if Catalyst is doing a BattleTech miniature, it's going to me. So it'll, you know, Randall Bills top the company, then Brent at art, you know, Ray Arastia, you know, line developer of BattleTech. So they'll hand it down to me. Here's the mechs we need. And then from there, there's a pretty clean cut from me as their sculpt director, and I'm still a contract worker with them. It's just full time, so it still pays good. It's up to me to assemble the team I want. So, and that's, I think, a pretty key way to how they work with me is there's so much logistics involved with managing this many sculpts at once, because you need to design it and then sculpt it, and I need to oversee that the sculptor is doing the best job possible. And then later we're doing line art. There's so much involved that if Ray or Brent had to do that on top of their other duties, it would just bog down. So I can just 100% focus myself on sculpts for the company. So then I've got guys like Alan Blackwell and Dale Ida, and I've got quite a few sculptors in and out, though Alan's just pulling it. Chris Lowry, he's over at PGI. He does sculpting with me as well in his free time. He's been doing great. So I've assembled all those guys. I've got, of course, Ben Bishop Steiner working with me on design. He's great to work with. And Harry Calio on design as well. And of course, you see, I end up doing a lot of the design myself. So designers, sculptors, and then usually the designers, some of the sculptors like Alan come around and do the line art side as well. But it changes around, balances who can do what. Like, you can have the problem if you're good at everything, then you get stretched really thin. So,
Yeah, and it's interesting. I think I picked up on the fact that kind of the process is almost flipped over the years to where it usually started out as line art and then to sculpt. And now it seems to almost be kind of sculpt and then line art. Was I understanding that right?
You are correct. And I think that is a key change. That's something I pushed for because, yeah, when I first came into the company, it was line art first, and the part of designing whatever mech you're working on was part of that line art process. So you've got to do multiple things. And while you could do a bunch of pre-sketching and get a design all properly approved, this is, you know, tabletop game industry budgets we're working with. Yeah. And we're working with pre-Kickstarter Catalyst budgets as well. So you're really pressed into getting a lot done, essentially doing some basic pre-sketch, and then a lot of critique and design work happening during the line art process. And line art is not very good for doing design work in, because you're trying to lock everything in nice and tight with clean lines. So when, I guess it was somewhat, the transition happened during the GOAC box production. At first, there was some pre-sketch, but then a lot of critique would still happen during the line art stage, and the line art did come before the sculpt. By the end of GOAC, particularly post legal issues where we subbed in a few different mechs, like we added the Awesome, the Catapult, and the Commando late in the process, just completely no issues mechs. Awesome. By then it was sketch and then sculpt and then line art. And we finally got to test this, like, using a finished 3D sculpt to do a faster line art piece. And then by the time we got to the Kickstarter, it was sketch, full 3D, and then line art, which just raises your accuracy level so much.
Definitely.
And the line art guys like it too, because they can work about twice as fast.
Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, then with those sculpts, you know, I'm curious, you know, as someone who just kind of started painting last year and is still very much in the novice stage, you know, you look at minis very differently when you're planning to paint them. And so I'm curious if in the design process, if kind of that is something that you take into account and consider, you know, how easy, how enjoyable are these minis going to be to paint, you know, as an added consideration complexity for making those 3D sculpts?
Yeah, that's something that's always in the mind. I mean, we're a little more locked into our comfortable process now, but early on, we definitely, you know, almost everyone on the team has painted BattleTech miniatures before. And we've got Dale on there who's now camo spec, so he's very interested in how our miniatures paint up.
Yeah.
So there's that balance of, you know, one, making sure our crevices are the right depth where they pool washes really well. And I think we dialed that in pretty good. So that's also a production concern with plastic. And I think they play off of each other. A good crevice for production is probably going to be good for painting as well. And then that proportion of, all right, how much big clean surface do we have for painters to flex their shading, or do we go heavy on all the fine detail where you can just wash your whole mech and it looks great. And I definitely say both between just general visual design and thinking of the little guys, I like having enough detail there where you could, you know, prime, base coat, do a little metallics, give a wash and then a dry brush, and like a lower skilled player can just have really nice miniatures ready to go. And I do feel for the guys that want to do all of their individual panel shading, but you can see we've definitely got a lot less large panels to go around. I try to keep in mind, okay, can we fit some decals on a mech? Yeah. You know, don't completely brick detail a mech into oblivion.
Right.
But yeah, I was thinking about that, and you know, is there enough cockpit glass to paint up? You know, sometimes the design just calls for not much glass, and I don't get bothered by that. But
and you know, the pilot's desire to survive, you know, combat is probably
exactly. Yeah, I think people need to dig in more. Yeah, some mechs are really good just using good old fashioned glass, and others you got to imagine there's almost a full digital Gundam cockpit in there.
Yeah, Bruins has a is working on a new animation, and I got to see a little preview of it, and he has a great thing just even just in the concept sketching where you see the panel of the mech get destroyed from the inside, and it was cool. It was the first time I had kind of seen it where it's like you look, oh, you're looking out of glass and like, oh no, that was a screen. And now there's a small laser, you know, coming into it from an elemental. So it was cool. But I appreciate the awesome, you know, in terms of that combination of there's great spacing for decals and not a big cockpit. So as a novice painter, that's like a favorite of mine to practice on.
Yeah, that one, it's the awesome somewhat where you'll occasionally see someone paint the whole forehead of the mech as glass.
Okay. Yeah.
But you've definitely seen the Thunderbolt where there's an access hatch on top and so many people paint it glass. It's now kind of a like alternate canon joke.
Because
we don't want to like jump into every internet post and say, hey, you painted it wrong. You know, paint your miniatures how you want. Some people really like having more glass on their mech, so I'm glad people can improvise.
Yeah. Well, that's all right. This thing is 300 years old. Who knows that someone didn't just like install a new cockpit design on
exactly
that.
I think Ben said that with the whole custom refit, you can buy a Thunderbolt glass hatch roof. Yeah.
Definitely. And I forget who I was talking with this about, but it may have been Alex actually in our podcast where we were chatting about the different designs and how the look from was essentially kind of a, you know, the Duane Luce line arts, you know, taken directly from the originals, and then, you know, the current stuff. And we were like, you know, there's factories building these things all over the inner sphere, and it's been 300 years. It's like, you know, the first Honda Civic doesn't look anything like the new Honda Civic. So they could still all be Archers, and they all exist in the universe. It's just like, you know, it's just like it's changed over time. You know, the Star League had this great technology for these curved, you know, armor panels and lots of production, whereas now it's just, here's a rectangle, you know, weld it onto there somehow and make it work, you know.
Yeah.
But you were talking about kind of the lawsuit, you know, and obviously there's threshold of what you know and you know what you can talk about. But I'm more interested in kind of how the resolution of kind of that recent lawsuit by Harmony Gold kind of impacted your freedom and flexibility just to work within the universe. Like, you know, where were the lines before? Where was kind of the no-go zones, and how has that changed since that was essentially squashed and never to return, according to the district court's ruling there?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting because so much of it, at least by the time I came in, was this question of like not what we are legally allowed to do. It's how far we had to tiptoe around a company that just really doesn't like us. Because yes, there's some of the mechs that came out, like the Warhammer, you know, the Unseen you got during the first wave of the Kickstarter, essentially. Some of them I may have designed differently post-lawsuit. Of course, they were all done pre-lawsuit. And like, I think the biggest one is the Warhammer. I would have done a bit more faithfully. I think I could have made a cooler Warhammer. Not only just because it had been like 4 years since I designed it. You know, I could have given it another pass, but I think most of them show that you see what that was what came out when I was trying to not upset them. And of course it upset them anyway.
Right.
But people like them still. And I think they came out pretty good. So going into post lawsuit from a creative side, I don't think a lot changed, because when I'm going in to redesign a mech or having someone else redesign a mech, we're planning for change anyway. And typically design is going to change an amount that in the courts is supposed to count as a unique iteration. Most of it was just not so much changing how we think about design, but just being like, okay, now we can just get on with our jobs and not worry about what's coming, not have to go through an extra stage in the process of like, okay, this is different enough, but is it really different enough? The other aspect is by the time that was done, we'd already redesigned every conflicting design anyway. So now we're dealing with redesigns of Unseen that weren't Harmony Golds. So we don't have to worry about them anyway. Maybe some of the VMI stuff, I guess, is still an issue.
Now, what's that for those listening? VMI?
Victor Music Industries, is that what they're called?
The two C's.
Yeah, when we had the two C's made, I'm guessing FASA, I don't know exactly how it went down, but I assume they went back like, hey, we sourced all this really good art from Japan. What if we ask the artists in Japan to design us a few new mechs? So they just went wild and made full mecha Gundam style
mechs. They look good. Course. I like those photos.
They're cool. Pictures. They don't all quite fit in well with our new style, and none of them showed the weapons properly.
Right.
But nonetheless, they're very good reference. I love working on redesigns of VMI stuff. There's stuff to come.
Yeah. And it was cool. It was cool in the Kickstarter mechs to see those two C's and see the inspiration, there in those. You know, there's some that are a little, like the Phoenix Hawk is a little too, dance floor-ish, maybe designed, but it was good to see kind of the look of the Warhammer and Marauder come out in those.
Oh yeah. That 2C lens was very fun to work on. The Warhammer 2C, has a lot of amazing, even the Phoenix one is one of the better looking Phoenix redesign mechs, so I had a lot to pull from there. And everybody loves Marauders, so I had to get on that Marauder. But that's definitely one of my favorite packs from the Kickstarter, and I'm sure a lot of people can't wait to get that one.
Definitely. And while we're talking about the Marauder, and I chatted about this a little bit with Alex, and I'm sure he dealt with this challenge a little bit more even than you, of when you are redesigning, of trying to take into account gravity, and how machines move, because there's certainly, some of those old scopes, the Stalker is kind of the big culprit, right? Of like, how does that actually move on the ground? But, back into those scopes and designing, how much do you try to kind of research just, mechanical engineering, have an idea of kind of how things would work and try to incorporate that into the artistic side?
I think that is kind of a general art rule, is a good artist is always observing what's around them. I will say I'm pretty bad at studying, like doing art studies, practice, stuff like that. Kind of work is where I apply what I think I've observed out there.
Okay.
Or, paying attention to mechanical design or other trends on the internet. But I could honestly say it's just when I go to design a mech, it's in the moment. Paying attention to like what's reasonable. I'd say the most unreasonable thing I do as far as reality goes is say if I'm redesigning a mech that had no torso twist, and you've seen I'm going and giving them all pelvises these days. But I might, so it didn't have torso twist before. If it works out to where it has this pelvis and it can move but not move too much, then we do that. We don't go all the way to make sure every mech could 360 degree torso twist around. I think the Marauder is one of them where it still can't twist very far. The King Crab has maybe 10, 20 degrees
yeah.
of total twist. But the Marauder, yeah, that one with its old feet, you know, its rear end all the way to the back, arms and feet all the way around the front. That's one where I had to fight pretty hard personally for it within Catalyst, because yeah, the Marauder is that at the very top of designs where old gamers don't want it to change.
Yeah.
And I think there's still going to be a lot of people into the future running their old Glogpod miniatures. And
I admit, yeah, I love the Macross designs. You know, they're
good looking. Yeah. Yeah,
they look sharp.
But that one I had to push pretty hard to lengthen the torso so that I've got enough to jut forward, but then also enough to jut backwards behind the waist, and trying to move the waist a little more to the middle instead of all the way at the rear. Like I even had resistance about that within the company. And they're like, no, move it more to the back. No, I want it to look like it can stand up. And I don't want it to have tiny upper legs and really long lower legs, because that's just mechanically doesn't work very good.
Yeah.
So what you see is the final Marauder is a very collaborative design. You know, it's not all mine. It's not all upper ranks. It's a very... very broad mix of people's opinions, very designed by committee. And a lot of the early mechs were like that, with the Warhammer, the Marauder, some like the Archer and Rifleman. If people follow me long enough, they know I designed all those mechs long before Catalyst picked them up, at least by a few years. And some like the Rifleman and Archer, they're like, oh yeah, change the knee pads and the calves and that's it. Yeah. And they're very quick and easy pickups.
Awesome. And you know, talking about kind of attention to detail there, you know, one of the big changes with the new round of sculpts is scale, and kind of having for the first time internal consistency there, you know, in the mech scale. You know, what was that like, kind of, you know, adding that, and kind of what are the reference points that you guys use to kind of ensure that new consistency?
Yeah, that's, I think, again, like, not only just good looking miniatures, but having a scale, a proper followed scale now, is huge for the game. And to be fair to the sculptors over at Ironwind, everyone's always trying to be in scale. The problem is it's never been something overseen from a central point. So for our Catalyst plastic miniatures, this is the first time where everything is all in one place and we can directly compare it and scale it. So at first for the GOAC minis, it was measuring all the old miniatures, having the bosses decide which ones they personally feel have always felt right in scale. So I'd say about 2/3 of our early miniatures, we were trying to stay pretty close to their original measurement, unless a mech was just never felt right. And then that's when we start comparing it to the other ones that we are trying to match. And of course, trying to match some of the more iconic mechs. So I think the Marauder and the Warhammer and such, they were really trying to stay close to the original measurement. And I think that shows when people get a little bit of shock, they're like, oh, all these miniatures are so big, or they see the most changed miniatures getting really big, like the Awesome and the Catapult. Yeah.
The Alpha Strike Awesome compared to the new Awesome, I was like, whoa. And, and I was like, I didn't like the new Awesome until I started painting, and now I love the Awesome.
Yeah. So there's a bit of shock, but when you step back and look, like, oh, actually most of the miniatures are the same size. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing we're finding is about, let's see, through most of wave one mechs for the Kickstarter, we were still trying to pick up a few key measurements from old mechs and having to fill in the gaps. Like at first, like GOAC, we had eight mechs, I guess nine mechs with the beginner box. There's a lot of weight classes we didn't have in, a lot of mech body types we didn't have in. It was pretty hard to get the scales dialed in, so there was a lot of committee there. But by the end of wave one, we had something in almost every weight class. A lot of weight classes had a squat, short mech, and a tall, skinny mech. And by halfway through wave two is super easy. So I have one 3D file with every mech in a line. Some people have seen the renders of that, and they're
Yeah,
like, "Oh, new."
sign up for Anthony's Patreon so you can see this.
Oh yeah, there's you
Or
get to see a bit extra there. But yeah, now I can just plop in a mech, stick it in its weight class, stick it between two mechs with a similar body type, because there's almost every body type and every weight class now. And we have a spreadsheet that Dale and a few other people initially put some data points into, and we have some auto calculators in there for height and volume. Volume's a really key one. And I'd say now, within 10 minutes or less, I can have the scale of a mech decided. And be at first it was okay, if we can get within a millimeter accuracy, we're doing good. Now I'm setting stuff down to the half millimeter height. Like, that's a level of accuracy you could never do before if you only have your own miniatures to compare to. And yeah.
Yeah, that's where the digital, advantages definitely come in. And now you guys are working, for those that don't know, you guys are working with Irwin's too, and they're going to be producing all of the variants. Is that right? For all of the mechs coming out?
Yeah, and that's I guess a more interesting subject now with was it Brent and Blaine getting their little side plastic biz started up, where they might be doing variants as well, or premium kits, and that's I don't know everything they're up to these days, so I can't answer to them. But for sure, the plan, at least part of the plan, definitely the full previous plan, is Ironwind making stuff. I know they will still be making stuff. People love their metal. There will always be people that want their metal.
The wait is satisfying.
Yeah, it is.
You got guys like Ares out there that kind of, get in, or just direct to Ironwind's metals. I see people making their pilgrimages and coming back with boxes of metal, and I'm like, oh man, that's a lot of metal to not be painted for ever or
Oh yeah,
years.
you can tell it's not getting painted right away. But yeah, we eventually take, that's another nice thing. We got just the centralized deposit of 3D sculpts. We can take them to Ironwind. Gotta make a few tweaks. Sometimes the way they need something shaped for production might be different. If a torso is just too big in volume, sometimes we need to split something up, because in metal you get the pitting, and then parting it up, so we've got all this multi-part miniature to go around. But otherwise it's a pretty easy process, so we're just working our way through the rest of the GOAK mechs.
Yeah, and speaking of kind of, materials and stuff, what was it that led you guys to kind of focus on that particular kind of plastic? And I know, certainly Ironwinds has the pewter, the metal, and then I mean there's others. Kind of Kids Logic came out with his own, which is resin, which looks beautiful, but I swear if I breathe on it, it shatters into a million pieces. And
Yes.
so, and like I would say, at least a quarter of them, if not 40%, come broken in the package anyway. And so, it's kind
Oh
of like, how do you guys, come up with that balance, and even, that decision to keep it all in one piece, and to kind of go away from selling the miniatures and pieces.
yeah, I think Catalyst, kind of the, at least the old deal, I can't say, so don't take my word on what their dealings are between Catalyst and Ironwind on negotiating how the miniatures work. But before, it was essentially, it was chill for Catalyst to make starter products, a box set. And then they worked out, the Alpha Strike packs. And I think because they have, they always have the Alpha Strike cards now, they can call that a different product. Because Ironwind has rights to BattleTech, but Alpha Strike is technically not a BattleTech,
Oh,
even though we
geez.
all know it's BattleTech. It's a different game. I think that's how the rights work. But there's, I think a lot of people speculate on that, or I see discussion of, like, are they antagonistic towards each other? Like, Ironwind and Catalyst get along, they're talking to each other. And while, yeah, legal processes and rights always have to be kept up on, friends can be friends to each other. So I think there's a lot of friendly agreement between those two companies. And so on the Catalyst side, it's what can be afforded to do, because again, they're doing these large runs, like Ironwind with resin casting and metal casting. You have flexible molds, and they're still work intensive to make, but they're much cheaper to make than a plastic tooling. You know, whether it's the high quality plastic or the cheaper plastic that we use, it's extremely expensive to set up. So you need to know what you're going to do and what your sales numbers are going to be.
Because I is it the are the metal ones are very easy to produce, but they have a much shorter half-life, and then the plastic ones are very difficult, but they essentially will last forever once you've got them.
Yeah, and I think even the metal casting molds, those do have a pretty good life, especially with the volumes that BattleTech requires. So, say Games Workshop would not want to do metal molds because they could probably wear their molds out. Resin molds are the ones that really wear out fast, especially if you got high details. So I've got no doubt that Kids Logic goes through quite a bit of molding. They have the benefit of that
That's
style of
good.
mech.
They can fix their mechs that break when you breathe on them. You know, it's
Yeah,
like
hopefully. And
I knocked
resin.
over my Warhammer on my table the other day, and it snapped
Oh,
off
no.
the SRM launcher. I was
I
like, oh,
guess
come
that's
on.
true. At that size, they're pretty fragile. I mostly have like 10 and 15 millimeter scale resins that I've acquired from
Gotcha.
projects I worked on, and they
Yeah.
will break, like you say, but they don't just combust at the slightest tip. Most of mine have broken at the glue points before they've broken at the resin, which is nice. But yeah, plastic, got to do a full metal mold. It's got to be engineered. Like with a metal or resin, you kind of pull the mold off the miniature, and it's flexible. So you can get all these intricate details where you can peel the mold away. But in plastic, where it's the plastic being ripped out of a solid metal mold. And so if you're too aggressive on your details, the detail's just going to stay in the mold. And then it's also going to mess up
That's a bit
the
mold.
next casting as well. But I think, so the golden question is, why are we not doing this really high quality plastic that other companies have? And the answer is, it's even more expensive to do and requires even more precision engineering. Like we have with the soft plastic, again, softness is key. It can be violently taken out of the mold and not guaranteed break the plastic. It warps it a bit. And that's why you see the warping in our miniatures pretty often, is they're just violently coming out of the mold. But if with the hard stuff, we can't do anything out of the rules. Yeah, everything must be to spec, and it's a level of, like, on our side, we don't have that technical expertise. We'd probably need to find maybe a different manufacturer in China or elsewhere. There's a lot of things you have to line up. So as much as everybody wants it, it's the plastics you're getting now is that's because what Catalyst can do. And I think on the plus side, one, they're extremely cheap. You know, $5 miniatures for BattleTech is something people haven't seen in a long time. And they don't break when you drop them. And you can adjust them with, the warm hot water tricks and such.
Yeah, they're easy to magnetize, so which I try to do whenever I can.
And
So
you're asking about the whole decision to make them one piece. And I think just as Alpha Strike is a quicker to pick up game, we wanted these products to be, as again, starter products. A new player can get these and they don't go home with their new game and now have to spend several weeks probably painting up really bad looking miniatures that they're afraid to show their friends. Like, you can go home and at minimum, you've got a pre-assembled miniature that's ready to play right out of the box. And that's just the whole thing there, is it we want our miniatures to be ready to play. And if you want your more boutique choices, you've got Ironwind and hopefully in the future these resin or maybe eventually plastic options.
Well, for the novice painters out there, because when I had mine, I was so hesitant because I'm such a perfectionist. You know, when it comes to painting, I'd rather take you know, 12 hours to paint something good than 2 hours to paint something bad. And I was like, and I also like don't have an unlimited budget like 99% of us. And so I was like, I don't want to paint this because I don't want to mess it up. And then I discovered isopropyl alcohol, you know, for stripping. And then I was like, the sky was the limit, man. I could mess up as many times and I could, you know, erase that in an hour and go. So for the novice painters out there, there's always people asking about what's a strip, isopropyl alcohol for an hour.
Yeah. And
you
I think
brush it and you got a brand, it looks brand new.
Yeah.
And again, it's awesome.
We see a lot of people likewise afraid to dive in. And I think, like, I don't know how often you guys talk paint. And first up, I don't paint miniatures myself. I stick to the digital. But the good tips I've been seeing go around is one, yes, you can strip your miniatures at any time. You know, your first probably won't be that great, but just go in and practice is what's key. In all the arts, you just got to do it. The more you do it, the better you'll get. You don't need some special training, just take in what you see and get to it. But other is don't go in and paint your favorite miniature first. You know, you'll be less afraid of screwing up your favorite mech, and you'll feel less bad about not having to strip your favorite mech. But you know, start with something that you're excited about, but isn't your most, you know, exciting mech, and work up to that one. So, because I've seen people that are newer, just getting into Battletech, it's great to see, and they paint the Marauder first. And then they go and paint their other mechs, and by the end of it, they've got this like amazing looking Wasp, and they're just okay looking Marauder, and now they're either so wiped out from all the work, or again, they're afraid of stripping their favorite mech, and they're kind of stuck with this mediocre Marauder. So paint your middling mechs first, and work up to your favorites.
Yeah, or even if like the from the GOAC box, you know, grab the Battlemaster and Awesome and the Catapult. They're very easy. Very easy, very painter friendly, and they're also all very easy to magnetize, which I also enjoy. So all the arms come off all those really easy, and even the torso and the catapult is really easy to take off. So those are good ones to start. And if you're lucky on the Amazon, I don't know if they fixed that $15 Amazon bug, but I think I have 13 boxes behind me because I was like, oh my gosh, I can get, you know, painting fodder for $15, you know, basically $2 a mini. It was good. Kind of stepping away from kind of the plastics and the Kickstarter stuff, you know, how, you know, kind of going back into kind of your role and kind of, you know, I know you were saying that Brent is more or less the art director and you're kind of the miniatures guy. You know, what's, I am curious, kind of having moved from a semi-official taking commissions to kind of a more full-time, you know, commission basis with Catalyst and having an official title, how has that kind of evolved your style, and you know, what in what ways have you kind of had to, you know, change what you were doing from a fan side to an official employee side, you know, maybe conforming to those specs of the higher ups, you know, Ray, you know, Randall, Brent.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think it's like less than you think. The biggest thing is always where rankings end up. Like, is there a boss above you? Because your average you know, freelance commission fan art kind of thing, while they are technically your boss, if both parties have done things right, your client shouldn't be commissioning something from you unless they want what you offer.
Right.
Unfortunately, a lot of people get in the situation where a client commissions someone and they're just doing it because they're an artist. It's not particularly because they want that artist or need their work. And you end up with this bad dynamic of nobody really being satisfied. But if you've done things right, your client just wants to see what you can do with their idea. And so as the artist, you're kind of in charge. You know, you have somebody that's satisfied, but you should already know what they want. And it's a really fun situation. But of course, the moment you step into proper company work, you've got a boss and you've got to make that person happy. And while some companies that are probably bigger, you might only be answering to an art director, and that art director might be trusted enough to make final calls for art. In the Catalyst case, at least most of the before, it was I would work directly with Brent, and then he would say, okay, I'm gonna go show your work to some other people, and then he would bring back all the feedback. Is probably mostly Randall and Ray seeing that stuff, maybe a few others, but now I'm just directly in the email chain. Anytime I'm handing in work for the team or my own work, it's Randall Bills, Brent Evans, Ray Rastia, all checking it over. So it's a pretty big committee. So you got to learn, being humble enough to take their critiques. So I'm also always trying to flex, like, hey, this is what I'm trying to push for your company. So there's the balance there. And a pretty key part is learning what your boss likes and adjusting to that, because it's one thing to take critiques in the moment, but if you then keep going back and doing the things over and over again that they don't like, you're going to just have this very abrasive interaction over time. So yeah, it does play in where even with my other artists, I'll see, Ben or Harry will design something and I'll say, hey, you got to change that. It's not because I don't like what you've done. It's because I know that's probably not going to pass when it moves up the chain. And yeah. I'm trying to save everybody time here. And that's, again, like I said, I'm trying to filter everything through so that by the time the bosses of the company have to deal with it, I've given them the most efficient interaction possible. So yeah, more as an art director level person, that's a big part of my job, is just streamlining everything, making sure by the time it moves up to them, it's all in a good shape. But honestly, Catalyst is very good about bringing in talent where they want to see just what that talent is doing. If you're doing TRO line art, yes, there's a very set style there, and not in any way per my request. Now, apparently the thing is to emulate my line art style. Guys like Plog are so great. They still get to flex their own abilities, which is good. Yeah. He's a much better line artist than me. I do not like doing line art myself. I'm a painter. So it's interesting to see when they wanted all this Kickstarter line art, they said, okay, make it look like Anthony's stuff. And so now I'm also training, anyone that does line art as part of my miniatures to, this is how you make it look like my stuff. And luckily, apparently it's quite easy to match, especially with the 3D. But no, like you've seen, like again in Legends and other recent books, they've pulled in fresh artists that are up and coming, and what ended up in the book is pretty much their personal style. So
let's throw a shout out. So what are the kind of upcoming artists that people should keep an eye out for, and maybe throw them some commissions along the way to help keep them afloat until they become official?
I'm pretty terrible with names. In fact, I think some community members like you guys have been doing way better at spotlighting new artists, because I've had my head down in this official work so much. And in general, I think I've pulled back from general art communities and social media for the last few years, just more offline social time is desired. So honestly, I have a feeling if I mentioned anyone, and I would have to look up their names, you've probably covered them already. Because for me, my turn was, bringing in guys like Alan Blackwell and Ben Myers. Like I saw them out there on Facebook, and Ben on the Mech Warrior online forums posting all this cool art. And when I finally was in a high enough spot to pull in people, I'm like, I gotta get those guys. And yeah, guys like Harry. Of course, always Bishop, if you like his stuff, go give him more work.
Yes, definitely.
He's down there in Mexico, and he's running his Patreon, and that's how the man pays the bills. So if you like his stuff, he's very affordable. I miss having the time and the extra leftover motivation to do fan art commissions myself, but I haven't done those in a while.
Yeah, well, I always like to kind of make sure people, know about Patreon, think about tossing a dollar or two, because it really is, you get a couple hundred people throwing a dollar, which makes $2, that makes no difference, it makes a big difference. And actually, with the finale of the cartoon, I've been thinking about, I had this idea, and it's kind of drawing on my kind of nonprofit experience and background and mindset, that I'd been musing on for a couple months. And I announced it kind of with that series finale of the cartoon remasters that I was doing with Renegade HPG. But it was essentially, I'm going to, and I got great response, so I'm going to move forward on it, but essentially create a Patreon for the community. It'll just be one level, $2. Obviously, people can give more than $2 if they want to, but it'll be a community fund. And then that fund will be used to commission artwork, you know, either from established artists, but even from new artists, you know, out there working in other genres and IPs to kind of try to bring their talent and explore that talent. And whatever they produce is free for the community. Mm-hmm. And I've got, you know, I think it was 250 people had responded, you know, that they were either down to hop in immediately or to contribute in the future. And so I'll try to get that up this week, and it'll definitely be up by the time this guy goes, but it'll probably be the BattleTech Studio is what I'll call it. And I'll blast out on my social media so people can check it out. But, you know, that'll be, you know, hopefully we can identify some new artists for you, Anthony, to make them official and
yeah,
get more artwork. But yeah, and it's part of the reason for that is that I know that, you know, for the official stuff, you guys do have, you know, criteria that you have to hit. You know, Catalyst has its design aesthetic, HBS has its, MechWarrior Online has its design aesthetic. And so you essentially have three official vectors for artists to kind of contribute, you know, in that more official capacity. And so it kind of limits you from bringing in, you know, what is this concept artist working for Lucasfilm that happens to be interested in Mecha? What could they do? Well, their aesthetic is not going to conform, and so we can't really mm-hmm. see what their vision is, you know, or Magic the Gathering artist, you know, and so hopefully this will be a way for new kind of ideas and perspectives to throw in, because, you know, for me, I'm a big fan of the old stuff, you know, the Steve Venters and the Bruce Jensen and certainly the Holloway and Lobenstein stuff. You know, there's some amazing stuff in the past, and it'd be cool to kind of explore some of that with this idea. But
yeah, that sounds really cool. And again, Patreon is such a game changer for, you know, all kinds of creatives. There's still a bit of, you know, mindset shift that needs to happen, but we're a lot further along than we used to be, because there's that idea of like, both from the artist side and the fan side, it can feel like cheating, like they're just being given free money. Like, shouldn't they be working for their money? but, you know, now we're seeing everybody's moving that way. And just like you're thinking of, it's way easier for someone to get involved, because, you know, everybody wants me to do a painting of their favorite mech or their favorite lance that they've been running. And it's incredibly expensive. Like, once an artist is, like, at my experience level, it's not cheap. And it always amazes me, even years ago, what people would be willing to pay to get some artwork out of me. But whereas Patreon, like you said, you can give $1, $2, $5, $10. And I really, I encourage artists to take the Patreon route. And I really encourage the community to get on there, because, you know, people say it all the time, but I think you really need to take the plunge. You're not going to miss that money. You're not going to miss, you know, if you're in at $1, $12 a year, you won't notice that money gone. I recommend at least $2 a month, because there is a fee in there. There's a flat part of the fee. So you want to overcome that. I think $2 a month is great. You're not going to miss $24 a year. That's a couple miniatures that you're not going to paint.
And it really is that kind of...
And in numbers, it requires everyone to get on the scheme. So if the math is there, if the entire BattleTech community decided to forget about $24 a year, we could have just every official and fan artist.
Yeah, we could have
BattleTech just funded.
We could have a Stardust level animation, you know, because that guy gets $20,000 a month, you know, from a bunch of people given $2, you know. It's getting them on board with the idea, and so that we can kind of support the creative process. And
so, viewers, listeners, get out there, like, support a few people on Patreon. Don't just do one, because then you kind of get the problem of everyone clumps to their first choice. Mm-hmm. So I think currently the leaders would be me and Bishop are doing pretty good on Patreon. But think about, all right, maybe you definitely want to give to your favorite artist in BattleTech, but then go find another BattleTech artist that has a Patreon, or just any artist that has a Patreon, and see, do they look a little undersupported? Give them your money. Even if you're not that excited about their work, if you just enjoy it enough, given those few bucks, because if, like you said, a couple hundred people do that, suddenly they don't need another job and they can just make art.
And they improve over time, you know, and that's mm-hmm. it. So recognizing potential instead of like the mature talent, like you were saying. And kind of on that, you know, on I always like to, when I can, you know, kind of pin artists down to talk about that process of engaging you kind of for commissions. And, you know, in my, while I was kind of stalking you on media to make sure I was well informed for this podcast, I saw you had like a GIF on your Facebook that was, you know, if, you know, the artists are safe from AI taking over their jobs, because that would require, you know, customers to give an accurate representation of what they need. And I got a tip of that. And I struggle too, you know, when I talk to people, of trying to kind of say exactly what I need. So, you know, maybe, you know, from you kind of as someone who takes commissions and people out there that are interested in kind of engaging artists and setting up those commissions. And we do want to make sure that, you know, both the artist and the customer are happy in that, you know, kind of what are your tips, you know, for engaging, you know, finding an artist and then engaging the artist and communicating kind of what you want out of that project.
Yeah, that's a good one. I guess step one is finding an artist, and that can often be the hardest thing. Like, even at my level of visibility on the internet, and I think I'm very visible on the internet, if you're looking for BattleTech, some people just don't find you, you know. My experience with that is typically someone using one of my images without permission, and they, when you contact them, they say, sorry, I didn't know it was yours. I'm like, well, a quick reverse image search could have done that. Yeah. But, you know, go on Facebook's really hard to search, but, and I wish DeviantArt was still the art community powerhouse that it was. I think it still shouldn't be discounted. You know, if you're looking for BattleTech art, you know, maybe go to DA and just search BattleTech and you'll see a bunch of BattleTech art. And I know there's still artists active there. I don't know how it is now, but, you know, the MechWarrior Online forums had a really active art forum area where you could find artists there. So, yeah, first there's some legwork. Just go around and try to inform yourself on the art community. And the BattleTech art community is pretty niche. I think the most unfortunate thing for me is there are artists out there that are really into BattleTech, and they just don't do enough of it to really get seen, because you'll see some artists just do an amazing BattleTech painting and it's the only one they've ever done.
Yeah.
And it's hard to tell, do they want to do more of that? But yeah, search around. Most artists will be cool with the commission if they're into BattleTech, but some aren't. Some want it to just be for their own personal fun. And so I guess I warn this mostly to artists, but I guess to the clients too. Some people just aren't going to enjoy doing something for money. The moment it's not their own spur of the moment inspiration, they might hate it. You could even ruin their enjoyment of art. For like, I've brought people into Catalyst and they're great BattleTech artists, and then the moment you tell them what they need to do and put a paycheck on it, they hate it, and then they're gone within a few months.
Or deadline, right? Deadlines are
deadlines. And for some people it even ruins it from the hobby side, so beware of that. But when you do find an artist that wants to work with you, number one, be quick and ready to talk budgets. They want to hear money, you know? And if they cost too much for you, just say, sorry, that's good. I would very strongly suggest that you never try to haggle down an artist, because we lowball ourselves already. We're very rarely are you going to find an artist that's charging high because they know it's going to go down. They're charging as cheap as they can comfortably work. My recommendation for an artist is start priced a little lower. You get more work out that way, gets you exposure on the internet. And then as you get more work than you want, that's when you raise your prices. You kind of cut out the bottom end and you keep working up and up. But don't haggle an artist. If you can't afford them, that's just unfortunate. There's another BattleTech artist out there that you can afford, probably. But then when you go to request what you want, If you really love what an artist does and you just want to see them flex their own creative muscle, and most artists will like this, you can be extremely vague. Just don't be too vague. So in the case of Battletech, pick a mech for them to do, whether you want it to be action or not, maybe a faction scheme that you would prefer. If you don't, tell them, give them a range that they can pick from. Maybe just a faction and not which unit. Whether you want the mech running or standing still, if you want it damaged or not, what angle you'd like to see it from, are the things to think about. But on the flip side, do not write a book. Like when you commission someone, not enough information is not as bad as someone that writes you 5+ paragraphs. We don't want to read your fan fiction about your character. Yeah. Yeah, so if you have a character that you want, like a pilot with your mech, just literally describe your pilot. Don't have them read a piece of fiction where your pilot is described. Just give them the bullet points. Mm-hmm. Photo references are great. If you can send pictures to somebody, that says more than words. Say if you have a certain vest you want on a character, show a picture of that vest. So just don't write too much. That kind of kills the mood. That leads back to the, you should only commission artists if they're doing exactly what you want to see. Don't ask an artist to do something they don't do unless it's very similar to what they do. Then ask them if that's okay for them to try something different. For example, a lot of people will come and ask me if I'll design the logo for the website. I don't design logos. I draw whole mechs, and a whole mech, as much as people want it, is not a good logo.
Yeah.
So just try to keep it loose, collaborate with the artists. Everybody's there to learn. An artist, you know, might be newer to commissions than you, then they're trying to learn from you. If you're newer to commissions than them, they're usually willing to teach you what they want to hear. And every artist is going to be a bit different. Some people do want more specifics and some people don't. I've heard artists say they were too vague. I'm afraid I'm going to do the wrong thing. If you're the type of person that does want to be vague and tell them to just flex and have fun with your money, tell them that you just want to see what they have to do and that you are not worried about what comes out of it. Because at least in my experience, and I know I've been a lucky artist in my career, 99% of the time, the art that you come out with is better than what your client thought they were going to get. So yeah, that's pretty long-winded, but
that's my advice for
commissions.
It helps people with that. And then you had talked about kind of finding art, you know, your art used, you know, without kind of crediting. I know I'm obsessive about whenever I use an art, kind of give a shout out to the artist or credit the artist. And especially, you know, with the custom CCG cards that I've been making for myself and hope to share with all those with the community once it's done. You know, make sure I have the artist on there for all of them. Like what are kind of the protocols? What are the do's and don'ts? You know, what, you know, how much, if something is out there, you know, obviously, you know, free on the internet is uncertain ground because it may not have started out as free just because, you know, it's mm-hmm. there. It doesn't mean it is originally intended that way. You know, what are kind of the, you know, how can people respect the artist in terms of what they're using art for? When should they reach out to the artist, when do they not need to, you know, kind of, you know, so that people know, so that they're not causing friction or resentment there from the creator side.
Yeah, that's good. I guess the first thing is every artist wants their art respected in a different way. I've seen people want to be very controlling over their art, and other people that essentially, if they could, they would slap a commons free use tag on all their art for people. They just want to see it out there. It's always nice to keep crediting with the art, because all it takes is one step for someone to reshare a piece of art without crediting, and that is not nefarious. But the next person that then sees your post and they have no idea who did that art, that's where illicit things happen. So for example, most artists will put a little signature stamp on their art. And so a big no-no, but unfortunately it's a hobby of some people, is taking artwork and cutting out the subject from it. Say in our case, it would be cutting out the mech so there's no background, and they'll wipe out the signature at the same time. And then they'll repost it somewhere, and then somebody else will see it like, oh, cool, this is all cut out and ready to go for me to take and put it on something and potentially even sell it. So if you find a piece of artwork and it has the crediting there available for you to see, or you know who did it, if you share it somewhere, say on Facebook or your Instagram, make sure you bring some crediting with it. If you can, even link back to the artist's portfolio or DeviantArt or ArtStation, what have you. Most artists, I don't think, will be upset if you just share the art around online as a, hey, look at this kind of thing. Where things get dicey quickly, like in your case, making custom card art, stuff like that. If it's low key, you're not distributing it, you're not going to make any money, it's just for fun. Context always matters, but in most cases, if you want to personally use some artwork, an artist is almost always going to say yes if you just ask. And they're almost always going to get really upset with you if you don't ask first. So often the difference between yes and no is whether you asked or not. And it's really unfortunate because I've seen people do things with my art and other people's art that we would have been ecstatic for if they asked us, but they didn't. And then it kind of becomes piracy. And now we don't like that person. So it's just kind of unfortunate things like that. Some people don't know how to hunt down crediting. Most of the time, people don't put in the effort to try. And it just takes a little effort sometimes. If you don't know who the artist is, take that piece of art to a large group of your community and ask them. Go on, BattleTech International. Somebody might be able to ID the person.
Yeah, that's what I always
But
do.
just ask the artist. That's the biggest thing. As far as some more hardline legalities, when we're dealing with official art a lot of the time, and artists that do official and unofficial, a little bit of the catalyst setup I can speak into is when we do work for them, we sign a contract and the art is now Catalyst Game Labs. We don't own it. They give us back the right to, say, sell prints at conventions, post in our galleries, stuff like that. But if you're looking to use in a low like yeah use somebody's art, but it's official art, you can't really go to the artist and ask, hey, can I use that line art piece or that book cover of yours? That's Catalyst art. So that kind of ends up your discretion of, are you using it a way that Catalyst wouldn't like? If it's just going on the banner of your website, nobody's going to be too bothered by that. But you don't really need to ask the artist because it's not their property anymore, kind of thing. So I get a fair bit of people asking, hey, can I do so and so with this art piece? And I said, well, it's Catalyst owns that. I can't really say yes or no. But I'll usually try to advise them on if they're doing something illicit or not, because it's very complicated these days with, like, hey, can I make a miniature of that? And usually the answer there is no, you should not.
No, I mean that helps me a ton. I mean, even for me, just kind of learning and kind of that my project with making those custom customizable cards that I made a point always to credit the artist, but I hadn't been kind of reaching out directly to the artist, and so I'll just make a point to kind of do that just to kind of double check, and certainly knowing art that's official and kind of reaching out and saying, hey, do you guys mind what I'm doing here? So no, that helps a ton, and I follow exactly what you're saying in terms of when you see it and you don't know it's there and that's the first time you see it, it's kind of jarring, even though you would have been okay with it right away. So that's cool. And then for kind of talking about kind of art and artists, I'm curious to kind of just step into kind of maybe a little art history and just talking about kind of the evolution of art in general, certainly more BattleTech art. But kind of, are there, historical artists that, kind of really stand out as kind of helped kind of inspire your work or that you're just kind of favorites from back in the day? And I know I was, throwing out some names, before in terms of the Holloways and the, Vallejos, are there any that just really, draw your attention that you really enjoy and that have helped lay the foundation for your own style?
I guess kind of in the midpoint of my interest in Battletech, I could say, Matt Plogg's always been doing great work with his line work because he goes way back and his style has evolved a lot over time. Some people might not even recognize his first work with his newest work and now the enormous amount of fan work he's been doing as well. He's shown a lot of improvement and David White for a while was pretty big and even because Alex Iglesias goes back a decent amount more than me that he's definitely imprinted on me a lot. I think that's pretty clear. A lot of people can't tell his and my design work apart. And I'll give people credit. It's you kind of have to be an artist to be able to identify different artists, especially when they're working on the same subjects. But yeah, I'm a younger guy, so I guess I could say a lot of the original BattleTech artists didn't imprint on me as much. It was more just the setting as a whole, and I got in through the video games a lot. And video game design crediting is a lot more vague. You often don't know who did the previs work on a video game, because definitely Mech Warrior 4, Mech Commander, and then I worked backwards in the Mech Warrior games rather than forwards. I was like, wow, these games are really fun. They've got something different that other video games don't have. And so I guess I couldn't say artist, but I could say just the style evolution of BattleTech's video games is what really got me into the setting. And then I started looking towards the tabletop side. I'm like, okay, so this is, at least I very quickly understood the tabletop is what came first. It's not the video games, because you see a lot of new people like, oh, BattleTech, is this an offshoot of MechWarrior? And then we grind our gears like, ah, how dare you? No, yeah, I'm one of those weird people. You always ask an artist like, who's your art heroes? And almost everybody has a list of artists that influence them. And I have a few, but I'm more of a broad strokes person. Like I could say outside of BattleTech, Kai Lim, he's a really cool sci-fi artist. So
How do you
ran
spell
into
that?
him. Kai and an Lim. He's part of a art studio called Imaginary Friends in Singapore, I believe. Yeah, when I started following him on DA, he's just doing cool power armor sci-fi art like me and interacted a bit. At one point he even listed me as an inspiration, which was really big for me when you're inspired by an artist and then they bounce it back at you. Now he does like he did previs for PlanetSide 2. He does previs for a lot of game that previsualization for people that don't know that term. Before you get the final designs for any big production, a big video game, a big film, there's the final designs you have, and a different artist might do that, but often very early in production, they just bring in some very broad strokes, talented artists to just make cool stuff. And then they pick out from that, what carries forward and modify it further. So he gets to do the really, that's some of the coolest work. But yeah, in BattleTech, it was just MechWarrior. And I say this in almost every interview, but BattleTech is why I'm an artist. So it's cool that I've ended up ranking in the BattleTech art setup.
Awesome. And kind of going into style, I know, I mean, you're a huge proponent of kind of digital and kind of going digital and, pretty much a necessity for most artists this way, certainly those that are professional. I'm curious in your perspective in terms of how that evolution in terms of the medium, the creation medium has evolved the final product. And I talked about this a lot with Alex, Ashley, because it's something I'm passionate about and talking. It's like a lot of that early art was painting, and it has evolved over the years to kind of this digital medium, painting on a canvas versus, painting now, which is in that kind of digital. What is your opinion, your perspective in terms of how that transition has impacted kind of the product and the style and the atmosphere of what's being produced?
Yeah, that's a interesting one, especially where you know, in that age bracket where we've been able to watch things go from, you know, painting on canvas, and then maybe an era where, you know, you reach far back enough, yeah, all the classic artwork we look at, the big stuff is these huge multi-year long canvas oil paints, and there's this paring down of, all right, we need to work faster than that. We can't spend 4 years on a painting.
Yeah.
And yeah,
well, were there BattleTech paintings that were that long?
Or no. I'm talking about art.
I know I'm a fan
back.
Of Holloway, but I didn't know we were spending 2 years on something.
I'm really curious how long some of those better traditionally painted covers took, because it blows my mind what some of them pulled off. Like some of them, I can't tell. Have they transitioned to digital yet? Is that traditional? Yeah. Is that digital? Because a good digital artist, especially if they were a traditional painter, can make their digital look like traditional. Mm-hmm. But it's, yeah, we've seen go from traditional to digital. Now we're seeing three-dimensional implementations in our digital, and now AI coming in. For example, Marco Mazzoni, he doesn't just use 3D in his stuff. Like, I use 3D in my big painted setups. He uses VR. So he'll jump into VR and be able to walk around his scene. You set in the mechs, pose them. He puts his laser beams into the 3D scene, casting the light and all that. I think they broke down the Toukiad cover a little bit that way on the Kickstarter. But, like, technically, I'm already behind the curve because I'm not always out hunting all the latest processes. But that's on the flip side of art is ultimately you can pick any medium you want. You just have to get good at it. Mm-hmm. And there's still room for traditional if that's the only thing you want to do. You know, for example, Bishop, he is slowly working on that digital transition, but he still sketches traditional. And there's room for that, especially now that we're designing our mechs in Sketch. We don't need really clean art for that. So that's made room for him when there otherwise wouldn't have been. Like his first gig for Catalyst was in the Shattered Fortress book, and he did a traditional pencil drawing in a print book, and we cleaned it up as best we could, and the transition from traditional to digital adds all this fuzzy digital mess, and we cleaned it up, and then it goes back to print, and all that mess just came right back, and it really bummed us out. There's all this pencil paper grain, and so that shows where there's limitations and why you really, if you want to be a paid artist, it kind of has to be digital unless you're planning on delivering a physical traditional piece to your clients, which is doable, but a much harder career to pick.
How do they even convert, you know, those paintings into digital? Like, what is the process of someone painted on canvas? Because obviously those old ones, you know, Bruce Jensen, you know, did, you know, those were on canvas, you know, they convert beautifully to digital. You know, what is that process?
You have to have, back then you would have had a good scanner or go to a lot of print shops offer scanning services, which aren't cheap. So they must have some really good scanning service going on, but your average home scanner would just butcher a traditional piece.
Yeah.
Eventually what we've moved to now, if you're doing traditional now and you want to get it moved to digital, is our camera phones are good enough. You just need just like taking pictures of your miatures, you need a lot of light hitting it so that your camera exposure time is as short as possible so that you don't blur your capture. You know, make sure if you have lights above you that you're not casting your own shadow onto the piece. So I was laying stuff on the floor and taking a picture of it with my phone, just try to stabilize it. And it comes out really good. If your camera takes the picture properly, I think taking a camera phone picture is better than using a scanner because you don't have that studio scanner. You don't know how to use it right. But we all know how to use our phones these days.
Yeah. Wow.
And that little bit of detail that it doesn't pick up is what evens out all the mess that you would get if you used a scanner on it. So yeah, if you've got traditional work, you want to get digitized. Don't be afraid to use your camera phone if you have a newer phone. Like I've got a Pixel phone and they have amazing cameras. But yeah, going back to digital, it's just so much more efficient. You can edit your stuff all day, especially not just like, oh, I can undo or hit erase. It's that you can chop up your work and reproportion it. That's the biggest thing, because a lot of people, like my design artists, they can do really good detail work and get the general idea. Often we found the difference between a pretty good redesign and nailing it is the foot is 2% too small. The legs are 2 to 5% too long or too short, like very, very small stuff where you could never redraw it on a piece of paper, but you can fiddle with that all day in digital. And that's the key to just pushing the design envelope. And yeah, it's, you're not paying for art supplies with digital. It's just electricity, you know, a one-time expensive computer purchase, but it's going to pay for itself so, so easily. Yeah, get yourself a Wacom tablet or a Wacom screen, or, you know, any of, don't be afraid to buy the knockoffs. They're not really knockoffs anymore, like Huion. I don't know how to pronounce them properly, but the budget competitor brands to Wacom, don't be afraid to buy those if a Wacom brand is a little out of your price budget. On the flip side, don't be afraid to buy Wacom products used, because they're extremely durable, especially if you want to get an Intuos tablet. Like, I'm not on a screen, I'm on one of these. This thing here is like a 15-year-old product or something. It's still going strong. They don't break. Just don't break the cables. So yeah, if you want to get into digital art, go on eBay, and because people are like, oh, that's really cool art tablet, let me buy one of those, and they don't use it and they sell it on eBay, you'll get just barely used mint condition quality product for half the price.
Awesome. I did that a lot when I started the nonprofit, which was an athletic program. And athletic equipment is great to buy used, because so many people buy, you know, training equipment with great plans to use it, and they use it five times and then they never touch it and gets pretty much new stuff at great prices. I want to hold your feet to the fire on this, and you know, and kind of ask you a question that, you know, in a lot of the new art, you know, I feel like there's kind of a loss of the kind of almost the atmosphere, you know, that was kind of characteristic in a lot of the older stuff. You know, it's kind of more like, here's a big cool shooting mech, and there's not as much attention, you know, built to the scenario around it, you know. And I've seen even just recently, I've kind of found some old Dugram art by Hidetaka Tenji, I believe is his name. But there's just that, you know, you see a difference there, and there's just a lot more atmosphere. There's fresh perspectives. There's other stuff going on other than the mech that just adds character to it. Certainly things like the old, you know, Tales of Black Widow cover, you know, or, you know, the Blood of Heroes cover, you know, there's kind of a, you know, there's more to it than just the mech, mm-hmm. you know, is, and I don't see that as much kind of in the new art. I think the mechs look amazing and the coloring is great, but it doesn't have that same character. Is that just the preference of the artists working in the medium these days, or is that something that's kind of been lost in going to a digital versus a traditional medium?
I think it's got a lot of points, and I absolutely agree with you. Like, I won't deny that at all. So one, especially when you get dialed into like a production pipeline work environment, it's really easy to forget to do that stuff. And certainly a lot of these like artists that you refer to, classical training does play a lot into that, you know, getting trained to remember to look beyond just your focal object. At first I was going to ask, do you mean like the paintings or the line art? But I think you're calling more to the paintings. You really have to go in intentionally about that. And it's really easy in the moment to just forget and be like, okay, I was asked to do this mech. Let me work on the mech and let me give it a background. Not like, okay, what's the scenario for this painting, before I fill it out with things. And Yeah, I really like a lot of the old paintings that were character first, and then there's cool mechs in the background. So the next, yeah, first it's easy to forget. In some ways, I could say us artists have really streamlined how we work with digital. It's not always about us being better artists because it's digital. It's made art more accessible to more people. So more of us can be good artists than before. And the third tier is, and I guess I'll be throwing some blame here, but maybe they can, if they hear this, they can give feedback. But I
Yeah, I
think
see where it's going. Yeah.
management, a lot of the cover assignments and even interior assignments, when they come down, it's we want these four mechs in the illustration. This one we want front and center. The art briefs are very often mech-centric. And I don't know if that's just like us artists often forget to think about the bigger picture and the moods. Maybe they're suffering from that. Maybe they have made a decision where they think they're going to grab more attention on the shelf by having the mech front and center. But unless we've all been misinterpreting their briefs, we do get briefs that are mech-centric. I think Marco and often Alex do a little better job, especially Marco. He does better at getting some infantry up in the foreground. But I guess the whole time I've been at BattleTech, I've never been asked to do a character front and center cover.
Interesting.
But I think we need more of that
Well,
for sure.
that's a huge, with my enthusiasm in the conversation to indicate that's a huge direction I want to take this BattleTech Studio idea is try to kind of get in some artists that can, definitely do something different than what the official art is, because I don't want to just kind of produce clones of the official art. I want to kind of use it to explore, artwork that would not come in official product that people would enjoy. And certainly that, trying to find some artists that's either artists have been doing BattleTech that have just kind of been on the leash, and kind of letting them off that leash, versus finding other artists that specialize that and kind of getting it in there. And maybe, best case is that, shines attention and the community really responds to that and enjoys it, then hopefully that'll trickle up to the official and they'll be like, oh, well, this is what people want and that what they want to spend their money on, then can incorporate it. So, it's a pie in the sky. Those are the dreams, right? But we got to start
No,
somewhere.
like you said, you've been going through the planning on that. I don't know how much that involves, catalyst and stuff, because I'm totally behind your Patreon community art thing. I just can't speak to that as far as approvals and
Yeah,
whatnot.
we'll
So
see. We'll see.
I hope that's something that can continue, because I think, like you just said, fan art has a lot more freedom. There's not only the budgetary limits, but just subject limits on what Catalyst is going to put in a book. And there's so much more that can be covered by the community. And that's something I really enjoyed when I was doing more fan art than official work, is just, well, this is what somebody wishes they could see in BattleTech, and they've come to pay me to do it for them. And yeah, I think, yeah, oftentimes the fan art is better than the official work. It's not until you get to the book covers by me and Alex and Marco and a few others where we just like totally flex our rendering skills
Awesome. Yeah.
and show like this is the best you can see this mech, which lately has been how many Marauder covers can we do? But
Well, on that note, what's kind of the piece that you've enjoyed or the pieces that you've enjoyed, working on the most that you're the most proud of kind of historically that you're just like,
yeah, I think
takes
one
well with a little bit
that,
of pride when you see it.
yeah, I mean, I'm a little bit famous for the Unseen Moon painting. Like Phil, multiple streamers have it framed behind themselves on camera, but and I set out with that one. I work with two screens, and I wanted one piece of artwork going across both screens, so I designed it to fit, yeah, two ultra wide, and I had just finished redesigning the Archer, Rifleman, Marauder, Warhammer, either for myself or for Phil, and over at No Guts, No Galaxy. So gotta credit them. They played a little bit into this whole Unseen revival. They threw up money to make sure I kept redesigning those, which got
Awesome.
Catalyst's attention.
Yeah.
And then somebody said, hey, I want you to do an illustration with all of those, but I have a limited budget. And I said, well, here's something that I kind of want to do. So if you throw in money, I'll subsidize the rest. And it, you know, it's, you know, get art done. So that's my piece I'm most proud of. And it's not the most published image, but I believe it is public. But I'm redoing that image officially for Catalyst. So some people have seen a Marauder and a Marauder 2 in Wolf Dragoon Alpha Regiment.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Burnt red color on the moon. So it's changing from Grey Death Legion to Wolf Dragoons. But over time, I will fully redo that painting. So that's been cool to revisit with all the official Catalyst redesigns that I've done. That one, it's, I'm most proud of simply because it's the biggest Battletech piece I've ever done. And nice. When, as I redo it, it'll have twice as many mechs in it. Mm-hmm. And it does, I wanted to bring that one up because, like you said, it's cool to see more than just mechs in a piece. I was like, hey, can I put some like more vehicles in the front or some some that. Vacuum suit infantry? Because they gave me the option for elementals, but I felt like that really put a fixed timeline on that piece. If I put elementals in it, it has to be like mid post clan invasion, whereas a lot of people like their succession wars. And so I didn't want to do elementals, and that kind of left me with no options to put infantry and stuff up in the foreground. You get locked in sometimes, but I typically, every time I do a book cover for Catalyst, I'm trying to do better than my last one. So I do have quite a few recents that I really like. My, I think the combat manual Karita with the bright red Wolverine in the front. That one just popped perfectly with that red.
That the color I have my, that's my Wolverine, the original Wolverine 6H, I think 3025 one, but for the card that I have, and that card looks great. The color really, it pops. It's great.
Mm-hmm. And then of course doing the Forever Faithful novel cover with the Timberwolf in the foreground. Mm-hmm. That one was fun because I finally got to do an official Timberwolf. I'd never been able to do that before. And then that eventually led into the official miniature, which you can see is almost the same design.
And I talk about this on all podcasts with artists, is that there's 20 missiles in those launch bays and not 15.
Yes. And that is the first time, I believe, ever, maybe there's some niche cases that the prime config was properly illustrated.
Yeah.
Because there's always like the double machine gun cheeks or the four lasers in the chin. Those aren't canon loadouts. Yeah. That just looks cool. So I think I was the first person to ever get the prime properly done. Perfect. Which just blows my mind that it's been so many years.
Claim to fame. Mm-hmm. Too funny. Yeah. And even if there in the if there were other loadouts with more LRM-15s, there's only one, and that has asymmetrical arm pods, you know, so it's definitely, you know, even the ones that, you know, that have the LRM-15, they all have symmetrical arm pods, so you're just totally killing it, you know, all you gotta do, it's, like, in the next manual, just add in a Timberwolf, you know, was it, O, or something like that, and that now it's, it can match it to your art, for the love of God.
Yep, it's always a funny thing with Battletech, how much art there is that doesn't match the stats, and a lot of that was original art with lack of communication or like art coming before stats and then realizing it doesn't work. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to fix up that you don't think you would have had to fix for the setting, but we finally have art accuracy with our weapons.
And you had mentioned Phil over at No Guts, No Galaxy. You and I had mentioned that I'd kind of listened to that earlier today, just to kind of prep for this conversation. But you had made a comment there about an affinity for Lego, you know, and kind of, I resonate with that because, you know, when like work stress was killing me like 5 years ago or so, I found Lego and I was building Star Wars Legos then. It was like an amazing stress reliever. for me. Now, I didn't branch out and do custom stuff. I was just building the specs, and it would just take my mind off things for a couple hours. But, you know, and you mentioned kind of building mechs, you know, and stuff of that. And I know, have you seen the Gothbricks on Instagram? Gothbricks 2000, I think, is the tag. But he does a lot of Instagram posts of his Lego mechs, and they're amazing. They look great. He did a Dire King Crab a couple weeks
yeah.
ago.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
Incredible.
Not closely following, but I've definitely seen the newer Lego stuff that people do for me. And it was back when I was more playing with my Lego, because yeah. Lego was just my jam for yeah, the longest nice. Time. And I was drawing, there was the overlap of the Battletech. So I didn't have enough parts to properly recreate a Battletech mech, but I was making mechs with my Lego for sure. But eventually video games took over my interest.
Yeah.
I still have all my Lego stored away. Back then it was Brick Commander. Do you know ooh. Brick Commander? They had a whole website, did an enormous amount of mechs. Now, of yeah. course, most of those were just done in digital, but they all could be made right. physically if yeah. you wanted to.
That's awesome. Well, the great thing about Lego is that, I mean, with mine, you know, I think I probably spent $2,000 on Lego over the course of a year, and I sold it for way more than that. You know, if you buy the right Legos, those things actually appreciate in time. I mean, I was buying yeah. Star Wars, which obviously yeah. has a great aftermarket, but yeah, I definitely made money on that hobby over time. But yeah. Oh, looking into the future with kind of designs and plastics, and kind of are there things that kind of stand out, you know, that you're really excited about kind of for the next wave of stuff? I know they've talked about doing Kickstarters for combined arms type of stuff. You know, aerospace, I think, is a little too niche for them to invest in, if I am right on my intel there. But, you know, what's kind of the stuff that's got you excited, you know, moving forward that, you know, assuming that you can talk about it?
Yeah, I mean, definitely combined arms, even for this Kickstarter we're wrapping up. I was like, you know, those are not everybody's doing combined arms, but I think more people would if it was more accessible. And again, if the vehicles looked better, because we got our ugly mech problem, we got a really ugly vehicle problem. These are products of their time. And they, you know, they had a whole TRO just for vehicles and a whole TRO just for aerospace. They made so much of it that was little room to make more vehicles after that. So we're stuck with these 80s tanks that are very 80s. And to be fair to the artists, I think often they were better at the vehicles than the mechs, because back then, I guess if we're touching on the evolution of art again, it's back then FASA had to pull artists out of nowhere. There was no Battletech community. You didn't have Western mech artists to yeah. pull. They pulled sci-fi artists, and they hadn't done mechs. But they could do some pretty good tanks. There's still the stinkers, but some of the tanks they hold up with a little bit of tweaking. So I'm looking forward to vehicles. I want all the most popular combat vehicles redone so that people can get their combined arms out without shame, because especially now you'd have these like cool new plastic mechs and then these old, out of scale, under detailed, goofy looking tanks on the table. And you see it, a lot of people are proxying their vehicles now. And there's a lot of, you know, clearly Battletech facing fan sculpts that you wouldn't say were infringing, because they changed them quite a bit. Right. And a lot of Battletech vehicles are generic looking enough. You know, it's pretty easy to make a unique vehicle, but often that's a good indicator of what Catalyst can sell, is what the third parties are able to sell. And a few groups have been able to sell vehicles pretty well. So it's like, yeah, I think yeah. we need to be in tanks. I'm with you. I don't think we should do aerospace, not without all new rules for aerospace. Yeah. But I think often the Catalyst thing is, this is a game about mechs. We need it mechs first. Luckily, some things like tanks work fairly well, infantry work fairly well. But the question is, if something like aerospace, and especially like naval combat, if it doesn't work, should it be redesigned to work at the risk of then, like, what if we accidentally make aerospace easy to play and meta, and then suddenly you can't have your mech fun because any competitive player is bringing a bunch of aerospace and bombing you. So sometimes it's, should we just leave it bad and then hope that's that nobody fine. Touches it? I agree. It's like, if you're realistic, air power is supposed to dominate, but we want our mech game. You know, if we're realistic, nobody can touch down on planet because a naval warship blows you up on the way in.
I think about that all the time back in the Star League time. It's like when they had warships, I was like, "What? How do your mechs get down to planet if you can take out a company of mechs just by blowing up a dropship with your warship?" You
know? But we need more tanks. We need more power armor. Seeing how much people enjoyed the elementals being thrown in, that was a really tough process, but I think we learned everything we needed to learn working on those. So I feel like, again, not speaking to what Catalyst is going to do, I feel like every Kickstarter or big release needs to have another power armor added to it. We can't just have elementals. But yeah, I'm right with you. Combined arms, we've hit a lot of the very popular mechs. There's still more to do, but eventually we're going to be scraping the bottom of the barrel. And I,
well, what's the scouting report on the favorites, you know, that didn't make it? You know, can we expect them to, the Vindicator, you know, the Firestarter, the Assassin, you know, those ones that that didn't quite make it, are those in the pipeline?
I mean, yeah, can't confirm or deny, but right. Catalyst has said we're doing more.
Confirm or deny.
Catalyst has said more is being done, and there's obvious, the second string is pretty obvious. So there's more cool mechs coming for sure.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And it's been great. I really appreciate it. We can kind of wrap, you know, for people listening, want to connect with Anthony, you know, Twitter, Shimmering Sword, you know, search Shimmering Sword, you're going to find it. Patreon for sure. You know, throw a dollar, throw $2 minimum, you know, to your favorite artist. Definitely, you know, throw Anthony on that list and DeviantArt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, other than those three, are there other kind of main platforms that you use?
Patreon, you know, you comment on Patreon, I will reply to you there as well. $2 a month gets you everything. There's no gating after that. There's a bunch of tiers above it that are just if you want to give more money. Even $1 a month will get you most of the stuff I post, maybe about half the stuff I post. Obviously that's always appreciated, but
definitely. Yeah. Well, it's in numbers, in those numbers. Everyone pick five artists that they could give $2 a month to.
Yeah.
It would make a huge difference. It,
that would change the art world if, you know, everyone that's a fan of art just gave, like I said, $10 a month if you can afford that. That's beyond some people, but you know, $2-$4 a month to a couple artists, that can just revolutionize the art world. We can have, you know, the patrons of, that's why they call it that, you know, artists
definitely
used to have their patrons, now they can have their patrons again.
Yeah, we wouldn't have you know, Leonardo da Vinci without patrons and you know, and many others, and so yeah, we can revolutionize it, or revitalize would be the better word. But excellent. Well, thanks again, Anthony. This has been a ton of fun. And for everybody listening, thank you for doing so. Definitely find Renegade HPG here on YouTube or on your podcast platform on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And stay tuned for the next conversation.